was an unknown wilderness. It wasn't long before they went into the wide valleys of Kentucky, through the Cumberland Gap.
Welcome to this edition of Old Kentucky Tales, the only podcast that solemnly swears that none of its participants have ever had to drink water. Participants. What do you think about that, Jason? None of its participants.
That plate it keeps dropping. Your upper plate.
I guess that's it. But none of us have ever had to drink water from a shell hole. Today's title is They Didn't Censor This World War I Letter. I am your host, Brent Taylor, Assistant Professor of History at West Kentucky Community and Technical College. And with me is the man who never says never, unless it's to tell people to never give a speech with their hands in their pockets. He is an associate, Professor of Communication at West Kentucky Community and Technical College, Jason Donner.
Yes, you see that you get it right. Get it right. I'm an associate.
You didn't put together that notebook just to be called assistant. Thank you very much.
I'm glad you kept going. I admire that.
Yeah. But do people put their hands in their pockets a lot when they're giving your speeches?
No, they really don't, actually.
Oh, you warned them about it ahead
right.
of time.
Yeah, they actually don't. But you would think they would. But some people are concerned about where to put their hands.
Okay. But they didn't do the pocket thing. That's good. You are definitely teaching the youth of America out there. In this episode of Old Kentucky Tales, our main event will examine a shockingly candid letter from the Great War. We will also hear history according to today's youth in our Kidstorian segment. And along the way, don't forget to support the fake history sponsors who support Old Kentucky Tales. The products are real, 100% real. Only the sponsorship is fake. That's a big snake.
I don't know about that. A sheep?
A sheep?
Yeah, maybe like a little baby sheep.
A turkey? You could feed it a turkey?
But they would do these, like this, you know, this would be offensive now if you ran this ad.
Oh, yeah, because the animal people would say, well, what about these poor pigs that you're feeding to the snake and whatever?
Or the dog?
They'd
make sure that you weren't feeding a dog to that snake.
That's true. But this thing had everything, didn't it?
Everything.
This is from 1899.
Like too much.
Three different circuses.
Sure.
I guess it's like a circus of circuses.
Uh-huh.
And then an aquarium.
A prodigious aquarium, yes.
I wonder how the aquarium works if it's a traveling show. Yeah, that's interesting, right?
Right, yeah.
I mean there's no telling what that was like exactly.
These were like these spectacles that would just travel around.
Yeah,
and they've got an aviary. Freaks, though. Where are the freaks?
That's interesting. But they had everything but that, right?
Yeah.
I guess they had the biblical spectacle. So, I mean, that's, you know, you don't have to worry about any freaks, right?
Right, yeah. I mean, it's terrible that they did that. But, I mean, that was part of it, the freaks.
So, yeah. Yeah. You can see that in several of these ads, just not that particular one. But that's a big, big show right there. John Robinson's.
Does it
circus.
Say on here what it costs?
Let's see.
I never saw that.
I think I have seen several of these. It must be a lot if they didn't advertise the price, because typically they're going to tell you down at the bottom that it's a quarter or 35 cents or whatever.
Yeah.
I've actually seen them where they are different prices for men and women. So they're actually going to, you know, cut you a discount depending on who they're trying to get to come through the door. It's kind of like, you know, ladies' night or whatever.
Oh, well, sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
And they bring somebody anyway, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's right. But, $100,000 show is what they said there. That is big, big money in 1899. If you're talking 1899, a dollar is a lot of money.
Yeah, that would be a lot to even pay.
So $100,000 is sort of like this incredible fortune. in that part of the century.
Costumes, it says.
Yeah, well, of course. You wouldn't have a spectacle without costumes.
I want to see Harry Houdini. Did you ever see Harry Houdini? You never did, right?
No.
Right.
No, no. I mean, but something like that would be pretty neat, right?
Yeah, that's what I want to see.
Those kinds of things. I think now, though, it's time for the cutest segment in the history of history podcasting.
Historians. It's a city, and there's cars right there.
Okay. What else?
There's bags of stuff, and I think the cars are full of junk.
This is one of those rationing things, I guess. Not rationing.
Yeah.
Collecting.
Well, yeah, they're doing a scrap rubber drive during World War II, and this picture comes from Hazard, Kentucky. And for a small town like that, they had a whole lot of tires there. That's a lot of scrap rubber.
Right. Is that – that's a tire, right, though? I mean, they look kind of thin.
Yeah, they're tires.
Just old-timey thin tires, they were probably, or an inner tube or
they
something?
They were probably some from the old Model Ts and everything. Yeah. The super thin ones probably were. But I thought it was pretty perceptive for her to point out that it's junk. And that's exactly what we're doing. We've right. seen ads on this show before where it says, bomb them with junk.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the kind of thing that they're going for there, that we're not going to throw anything away. We're going to use it all for the war effort. And it's patriotic for you to
sure.
to bring it in. And we're going to, it's a community event, and we'll give it to Hitler.
Right. It was metal, everything, right? I mean, what were
metal.
The main things they did then? It was rubber, metal.
There's also some other things like rags.
Oh, really?
Rags are another one where they're going to have a scrap rag. Nylon is a big one.
Okay.
So the whole thing about, like, you know, women's leggings and whatever,
yeah.
that kind of stuff, we're throwing all that into the war effort. Tin cans are another one.
Did food get into that too, or was it more a matter of, like, rationing food because there weren't people to really produce it?
Yeah, we are rationing it. You can also produce it with victory gardens. We had something like that where you're supposed to go out there and grow it on your own. But we've got the rationing books,
right.
and you've only got a certain allotment for every period of rationing.
Yeah.
If you run out of sugar stamps, then you're just out of sugar.
Yeah.
You don't have any until the next period comes around. They are the original reduce, reuse, recycle
right.
generation, that World War II.
That was something anybody could do to help.
Sure. If you're at home, you're on the home front. We call that the World War II home front. That is exactly the way that you can help win this war. You might not be out there shooting guns at Nazis or something like that.
Right.
But you might be able to turn in your old tires, and mm-hmm. you have contributed to the war effort that way. That's entirely what it's all about. And it's kind of funny that we had World War II because our main event deals with World War I. And that is the moment we've all been waiting for.
The main event.
Round one. All right, Jason, are you ready to nerd out on some history here a little bit?
What else could we do?
That's the entire show, right? But this one is going to be especially nerdy because hardly anyone has ever seen this source.
Okay.
This is a very rare source. It was buried deep inside a newspaper, and I have transcribed it.
You found it.
I found it.
What do you mean you transcribed it? Was it in French?
I didn't translate it.
Okay.
But I took it from its non-digital
yes.
source and put it into a digital source.
So maybe something like there's tons of stuff that no one's acknowledged later, but we're about to talk about a letter that somebody wrote, probably been forgotten.
Oh, long.
1918.
Long lost and forgotten.
That's
this is World War I.
That's 100 years, Brent.
And great observation. This
I
is
did the math.
It's the 100th anniversary of the end of World War I, which is also a big deal in the history circles. Yep, you are 100% correct there.
Is it really?
Yeah.
So you guys have, like, parties and stuff?
We have...
Where's your hat?
We have boring conferences where we talk about how to
right.
teach World War I. I just got back from one last weekend.
Okay.
That's 100% true.
Yeah, they went crazy up there. History professors.
Yeah, there ain't no party like a history conference party, because a history conference party don't stop.
Okay.
I think that's how it goes.
That sounds familiar. Go
yeah.
on. All right. Let me stop you there. I know you hate it when I like throw you off.
Let me start you there.
Doughboy. Okay, yeah. That's a thing that we've all heard. Why do they call them doughboys?
Nobody knows the answer to that. There are some theories. There are some theories about it. I'll tell you one of the most prominent theories, which is it has to do with military cooking. And so you're out there in the field and you're trying to get a warm meal and you've got a little campfire going and you cook things a certain way.
Right. You're limited.
And so there's some theory that that's related to that.
Okay.
But nobody's 100% sure where it came from.
That got lost to history. I mean, it's not that long ago.
That's true.
People would have written stories about it in books.
Yeah, you would think somebody somewhere has said it, but it's still kind of a mysterious thing. Maybe I think it's a little bit older than World War I, possibly in its origin or something. But yeah, that's a good point also. This guy's name was Thomas Stone, and he wrote a letter back home, and then the people back home saw that the local paper was calling for letters to be published. So then they passed the letter along, and this is what the letter said.
Who's he writing to here? Do you know?
He's writing to a family back home.
Okay.
Your interesting letter came to hand some time ago, but I haven't been in a place to answer it. Have been on the front all of that time. That's the Western Front in World War I, very famous. And no mail was taken at headquarters. Anyway, where the shells are breaking and the bullets flying is no place to write. Have been in battle, came out without a scratch, but had to feel to see if I was wounded when a big shell hit near me as it knocks you over. This is the first really modern war.
Right.
And we've got a lot of things on the battlefield that are bigger.
Like explosives.
They're very dangerous, very explosive. We've got heavy artillery here. One of the German guns was called Big Bertha, and it was a 43-ton weapon.
Right.
They have to haul it around with trains and tractors and things like that. I mean, this is an industrial-sized war, which is the first thing that people usually point out about World War I.
And you just want to build the biggest one bigger than the other guy.
That's exactly what it was. In the fancy terminology, that's militarism. We say that there are four main causes of World War I, and militarism is the M and the main acronym. Okay. And I is industrialization, because you can mass produce all these things.
Yeah, it was a period where they could actually build these giant machines or just weapons. Yeah.
Yeah.
So he
experienced
something blows up, and then you're like, oh my God, am I okay? Is everything still attached?
Right, because it knocks him down and the whole thing. So he's gotten up from that, you know, possibly concussed or some such injury. Have seen a great deal of war, hardships, and all that goes with war, and I am still in the best of spirits. We could not get anything hardly to eat for 6 days. Now, I have my stomach all torn up from eating too much. In World War I also, they did a voluntary rationing. It wasn't the mandatory rationing of World War II, but the whole idea is we've got to feed the army, so you people need to be cutting back at home so that we can send it over.
Right, yeah.
It's the same kind of thing. Both World Wars had that kind of element to it.
Yeah.
And apparently, when you're way out on the front, you have trouble getting the supplies.
They're eating out of cans, I guess?
It would be some things like that. I don't know if they've quite got the sea rations yet, but it would be something akin to it.
Right.
Whatever they can get you out there. My men are the same way, so they were also had eaten too much after not having something to eat. We drank water out of shell holes and a creek that had dead Germans and horses in it.
Well... That doesn't seem necessary. Yeah.
Well, if you're thirsty, it is.
I guess. I don't know. I guess they knew how to boil it maybe and sterilize it. Maybe.
I bet not. I bet that in a pinch and...
I mean,
you're out there.
Yeah.
But lips were parched and stomachs empty, he says. That's the explanation.
Right.
Still up the valley we went, feeding into the line under artillery and machine gun fire. The machine gun is another big weapon of World War I. They had had them on a limited basis in some previous wars, but this is the first one where it is a mainstay of the war.
Yeah.
And it changed warfare.
Now, is it a personal gun, or is it still just like artillery that they bring up?
These are mainly big machine gun nests.
Yeah.
So it's like a 50 caliber kind of situation where you got three guys running it.
Right.
And then that kind of thing. That's basically the ones I have seen are the big ones. Me... smoking a cigarette every time I gave the command, if it meant instant death. So he's nervous out there. He's giving orders that could mean, you know, somebody gets killed. And so he's smoking then to kind of fend off
that nervousness. Relax.
That's a very 20th century way of looking at cigarettes, right?
Oh, sure. People think, well, that's why they smoke. Some people, they believe they got to do it to relax.
Yeah. We got the Hun's goat and got up out of his hole, and he would come while others still clung to their machine guns. They would say, "Comrade," but the men shot most of them full of holes or ran the bayonet through them. Some got away by other officers' orders, but my order was to take no prisoner, for they had Red Cross bands on their arms while operating machine guns.
Explain.
Okay. So this would probably be considered a war crime today.
Yeah, they're like trying to fool them.
Right. And they've got Red Cross bands on their arm, which is supposed to be a sign that you are out of bounds, off limits to shoot.
Right.
But it's all a ruse, and they're shooting these machine guns.
Yeah.
And then what's happening is we have taken the gloves off in response. And we say, okay, if we see that, don't try to throw your hands up. This thing about comrade, that's where they're surrendering. And they're trying to say, hey, I'm, you know, friend, right. don't shoot me.
Right, right.
Hey, yeah, and that's just not going to fly here, according to this guy, that they're not putting up with it. To my knowledge, only five got to our lines with their hands up as prisoners. We chased them out of a big farmhouse, and immediately I established my company headquarters in it, and the furnishings in it were the finest I ever saw, what was left of it. Big destruction in World War I. You can kind of get a little glimpse of it right there. And the Germans on the front and right kept a stream of machine gun fire to no avail. Anywhere the Hun meets the Yankee in the front, he gets the fear of God put in him. Even their very best troops.
What's with the Hun? We hear that too.
That is a derogatory word that was used for the Germans back then.
Okay.
And so...
born out of what?
I guess ancient history with the Huns and ethnic. Like they're sort of barbarous.
Okay.
Probably that's what that is. But it's an old term, and they were using it here just to describe the Germans as some pretty bad guys. I have seen some in my company, even from the old 2nd Kentucky, to which I belonged for 3.5 years, and must say that all have the same American fighting spirit, anxious to get at the Boche. And that's another one of these terms. That's actually a French term right there that we used. They were using it for the Germans, and then we adopted it from the French.
Mm-hmm.
Some men got as high as 6 to his credit. I had my hands full leading my men. We ate their rations from the dead, took their pistols, field glasses, anything of use to us. So we can see here a little bit some of the spoils of war. They had plenty of solid alcohol, which we used to an advantage cooking. I am even writing this on German paper to you, taken from a pack on the battlefield.
Right.
Have lots of it too. Also a sniper's rifle, a bayonet that I carried all through the battle, as I lost my revolver in the first fight my platoon had. So that's crazy, right? Because you imagine you lose your weapon in the very first fight. So now he's got to find another weapon.
Yeah, and end up using an enemy's weapon. And all this stuff, so much of it came back to the United States.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, I'm not. That's how we have those things.
Right. I'm not sure about the paperwork on this one, but in World War II, there was paperwork. There was a form you could fill out that say, hey, I found this German pistol and I'm
really
bringing
had
it back.
To declare it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm not sure if they quite had gotten that level here. They might not have. World War I is really funny. It's kind of modern, but it's also kind of old school at the same way.
Yeah.
It's, you know, you might see a tank out there, but you might also see some horses.
Right, yeah.
It's just a really funny time where it's kind of straddling.
It's an in-between time, right.
It is. It's a tweener as far as wars are concerned.
Well, it always makes me laugh.
Well, yeah, yeah. I don't know about that.
Right,
but,
yeah.
But anyhow.
No.
But anyhow. What you see later in the letter is that he's looking forward to coming home. And that's a major theme that you'll see in some of these things. But another thing that I thought was really nice about this particular letter is that it is really candid. He's got all
really detailed.
It's very detailed.
Yeah.
That might also be a difference between World War I and World War II. I know in World War II, they were very careful about the kind of information you were sending home.
Yeah.
And they censored letters and things. This doesn't appear to be quite as cautious. And I don't know if that's a throwback to older wars when maybe you didn't have to worry about it so much. But
maybe in World War II, they thought more about Japanese spies, German spies, you know, people in America. But there was a real concern about that they were helping the other side.
Oh, sure. Yeah, that was a big worry. That's where a lot of things like that came from, with the Japanese internment camps and everything.
There's something in here I got to point out to you, though.
What is it?
I just spotted it. And it's interesting. 1918. He says, we have new uniforms, shoes, underwear, and we got rid of the cooties.
Yeah.
That's such a little kid thing to do. But I mean, I guess it still goes on. I don't know. Happened to me in grade school.
Now, the real cooties are lice. So apparently they had a little infestation there.
It's just funny to see that. You know, because it makes him, I don't know, it's just like it's not that far removed from what we are.
Yeah, I think that's a good point about that as well.
I'll save that for my takeaway.
Ooh.
Cooties.
File it away. Okay. But when we get there, you can use it. We'll let you bring it back up.
Right.
But right now, we got to pay a few bills. And our sponsor for this part of the program is Interstate Finance. Take a real vacation this year. Better today. Live better today with the Interstate way. You and your family deserve it. A vacation loan. With our easy on you monthly payments, we'll solve your money problems. Stop or phone the office today. Okay.
So they're pitching, like, take a vacation. Now we have the Interstate.
Yeah, because it is from 1958.
Yeah, borrow some money.
Borrow some money.
To take your vacation.
Hit the road. Would you ever borrow money to take the vacation? Like, money you weren't going to have.
Right. It says right here, it'll solve your money problems.
Wow, that is so backwards.
But it's a little pitch, you know.
It is, but I mean, I just can't even imagine. You're like, you're running low on money in the first place.
Uh-huh, but you really want to go on that trip.
But you deserve it.
Yeah.
So,
and there's this interstate where you can go fast. No stoplights.
Yeah, you can tell they're trying to be cutting edge, because, I mean, if you're going to name your something futuristic, that would be Interstate in 1958. No question about it.
I love that period of time, too, that 50s, that post-World War II, where they, so much, you know, built into the infrastructure, but Eisenhower building those interstates, I mean, tons of benefits, commerce, just travel, connecting the states.
Yeah.
I mean, that wasn't there before, so we're talking two-lane roads everywhere.
Yeah. A really funny thing you can see is a map of major roads in the United States before the interstate system.
Right.
And there's a few roads up in the Northeast. There's one road that runs along the West Coast. There's a road that kind of runs about halfway across Florida.
Yeah.
But not the other half.
Right.
There's maybe one more road part of the way through Texas. It was very incomplete.
Right.
But then this really gave a complete
set
of roads to America. It was a pretty big thing in its time, for sure. But now it's time. Are you going to bring it back up?
Oh.
Your big takeaway?
Let me think about it for like a second and a half. Let me think about it while I complete this sentence. Well, I don't know. I think it's good to be like a letter. I guess that's what we have. I mean, that's the record that we have about how people felt in that day. And then you can tell. You can see the parallels with people now. I'm getting really deep.
Okay.
And back then. But they're just people. They're people fighting these wars, right?
Yeah. Regular guy.
So it's important.
Called into
service. It's important
to
review these, like, because this is how he felt. This is just a regular person riding back home.
Yeah. Yeah. And we see the attitudes towards the Germans. And really, that's reflective of the whole society. The idea was that the Germans were the bad guys. They were breaking all the rules. They're invading neutral countries. They're wearing Red Cross armbands while they're trying to operate machine guns. They deserve anything they get. And we've actually seen that in the show before, too. Remember the Kaiser? What shall we do with the Kaiser in previous episodes?
Right.
Same kind of thing. They did not have any kind of bad feelings about what they were doing to the enemy there.
Yeah, the enemy, exactly.
We have now turned to the final page of this chapter, but never fear, Old Kentucky Tales never fails to return. Even after that last episode, we still returned.
But hold on.
What?
Future episodes.
What kind of future episode is there?
What do we have coming up?
A Christmas episode, perhaps?
We have a Christmas episode.
Oh, so
I guess we're bound to do that at some point. That was going to happen.
You can download other episodes that have been previously recorded on iTunes or the NPR One app. If you like what you hear, please leave a review. Please leave a review or rate us. If you did not like what you heard, then there's no way you were all the way here at minute 25.
They should go back and remember that we have a Christmas episode.
They should remember that.
That doesn't make any sense. Okay, go.
Special thanks to our producer, Todd Birdsong, the Paducah School of Art and Design, and WKMS, and the rest is history.